Next, we turn to the simile of the vipers. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Run, 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 the near shore is full of dangers, 4 poisonous vipers, 5 murderers, and 6 robbers. Run, 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 run to the far shore that is safe and secure, Nibbana. Few among men are those who cross to the farther shore. The rest, the bulk of men, only run up and down the hither bank. Dhammapada 85. A very important sutta, especially for those who want to fully know the practice of insight meditation, is the simile of the vipers from the Samyutta Nikaya. This sutta starts with the following story. A man had committed an offense. The king wanted to put him in jail, but could not find any evidence, so the king assigned him the job of looking after 4 poisonous snakes. Every day this man had to take care of the snakes. From time to time, the snakes had to be fed, to be picked up and put down, to be bathed and to be put to sleep. The man thought this task was a reward given by the king, and very happily he did his duties. But one day, a wise friend approached the man and told him that if one or another of the vipers ever becomes angry with him, the man would meet his death or experience deadly suffering. So he should let go of the snakes and run. So the man, now afraid of the 4 vipers, full of fierce heat and deadly venom, fled first in one direction and then in another. The ministers reported to the king that the man had fled. Then the king sent 5 murderers to chase after the man. The man's wise friend appeared again and told the man that 5 murderers were pursuing him, wanting to take his life on the spot if they found him, and that the man should run as fast as possible. So the man, afraid of the 4 poisonous snakes and the 5 murderers, fled first in one direction and then in another. When the king found out that the snakes and the murderers could not kill the man, he spoke to his ministers. First, when he was pursued by the vipers, he fled here and there, tricking them. Now, when pursued by the 5 murderers, he flees even more swiftly. We have not been able to catch him, but perhaps by trickery we can. Therefore, send as a murderer with drawn sword an intimate companion from his youth, one who used to eat and drink with him. Because this person has been his intimate companion, the man will not be aware that he is an evil intention. The ministers then sought out such a companion and sent him to murder the man. Luckily, the man's wise friend appeared again and revealed the truth to the man. He told the man to be wary and run as fast as possible. Now the man was afraid of the 4 snakes, the 5 murderers, and another murderer with drawn sword who pretended to be his intimate companion. He fled further and reached an empty village that had only 6 houses. Whichever house he entered was void, deserted, empty. Whatever cooking pot he lifted up was void, hollow, empty. The man thought it was time for him to rest and that he would remain in the deserted village for a while. But the man's wise friend appeared and told him that the village had just been raided by 6 robbers, who may return, so the man should not stay there and should leave immediately. Without resting, the man continued to flee until he came to a great expanse of water where the current was swift. The man realized the near shore was frightening and full of dangers, the 4 snakes, the 5 murderers, the 6th murderer with drawn sword who was the intimate companion, and the 6 robbers. But that the far shore was safe and free of dangers. However, there was no ferry boat or bridge for crossing over from the near shore to the far shore. Then the man thought, "Let me collect grass, twigs, branches, and foliage, and bind them together into a raft, so that by means of that raft, making an effort with my hands and feet, I can get safely across to the far shore." So he collected grass, twigs, branches, and foliage, and bound them together into a raft. By means of that raft, making an effort with his hands and feet, he safely crossed to the far shore. After crossing over and going beyond, the man stood on high ground. Here's a summary of the metaphors. What are the 4 poisonous snakes? They are the 4 elements. Who are the 5 murderers? They are the five aggregates of clinging. Who pretends to be an intimate friend but is actually an enemy? This is craving. To what does the village with six empty houses refer? The six sense bases. Who are the six attacking robbers? They are the six sense objects. What is the great expanse of water? This represents the four floods of sensuality, existence, becoming, and ignorance. The near shore, which is dangerous and frightening, is a designation for identity view. The raft that helps the man cross to the other shore is the noble eightfold path. Making effort with one's hands and feet is a designation for the arousing of the fourfold right effort. One has to walk the path by way of one's own effort. The other shore is nibbana. Crossing over, going beyond, and standing on high ground is a designation for the arahant. The four elements, five aggregates of clinging, craving, six sense bases, and six sense objects, identity view, the four floods of sensuality, existence, becoming, and ignorance, the noble eightfold path, the fourfold right effort, and nibbana, are all dharmas that should be known by one pursuing the path. The four elements. Why are the four elements represented by four poisonous snakes in the sutta? To understand this point, we have to train in the four elements meditation. This particular subject of meditation is undertaken to understand the reality of the body as it actually is. The Lord Buddha taught the four elements meditation in two ways, in detail and in brief. The Buddha taught the brief way in the Discourse on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, given to the Kuru people, who were very sharp and quick to understand. The Buddha stated, "A recluse reviews this very body, however it is positioned or placed, as consisting of just elements, thus. There are in this body just the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the wind element." Such concise instruction is beyond the comprehension of most of us. What of those who have sluggish wisdom? For them, the Buddha taught this subject in detail in the discourses Exhorting Rahula and Analysis of the Elements. In these two middle-length discourses, he skillfully used conventional truth to bring about the realization of ultimate truth. In reference to the earth element, his instruction is as follows. Monastics, what is earth element? It can be either internal or external. What is internal? Whatever is taken as belonging to oneself that is solid, substantial, and clung to. Head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solidified, substantial, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. This body, which is seen in conventional reality as an undivided unit, is composed in ultimate reality of the four elements, earth element, water element, fire element, and wind element. The Pali word dhatu, translated as element, is an ultimate property or characteristic. Each of the four elements has its own particular characteristic. What is the characteristic of the earth element? When we see the earth, what strikes the mind? Hardness. Hardness is the characteristic of the earth element. Its function is to act as a foundation for the other primary elements, and it manifests as receiving the other three elements. The earth element has six aspects that exist in relation to one another. 1 and 2, hardness versus softness. 3 and 4, roughness versus smoothness. 5 and 6, heaviness versus lightness. Hardness and softness cannot exist together, but are relative to each other. When something is not so hard, it is soft. The same relation exists in the other two pairs. When something is not so rough, it is smooth. When it is not so heavy, it is light. Understanding these relations is fundamental to discerning the earth element. One starts the practice of four elements meditation by reciting the 20 parts of the body that have the earth element as the predominant factor, head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, and brain. As the parts are recited one by one, gradually the hardness becomes clear. To help make the characteristic clear, you can bite down or clench the teeth to feel the hardness. Then move your awareness from the top of the head down to the soles of the feet to discern hardness in the body. When hardness becomes clear throughout the body, you can start to discern roughness. You can rub your skin to feel the roughness and move your awareness from the top of the head down to the soles of the feet to discern roughness. Move your awareness in the same way to discern softness, smoothness, heaviness, and lightness. The second element is the water element. When you see water, what first appears to mind? Flowing. Thus, flowing is the characteristic of water element. How can the water element be discerned in the body? There are 12 parts of the body that have the water element as the predominant factor. Bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, joint oil, urine. When you think of sweat, blood, tears, or urine, the characteristic of flowing will become clear in the mind. According to the Abhidhamma, the water element cannot be sensed by way of touch, as it is not a tangible object. The water element can only be discerned by the mind. If you touch water, you may feel pressure, but pressure is an aspect of the wind element. You may feel cold when touching the water, but coldness, temperature, is an aspect of the fire element. You may feel the softness of the water, but softness is an aspect of the earth element. You cannot feel the flowing of the water. Flowing cannot be discerned by way of touch. Another aspect of the water element is cohesion or binding, and this is the force that binds the body together. All of our organs are bound together because of the water element. Without the water element, the organs and limbs would scatter, and there would be no shape. In meditation, sometimes one feels tightness within the body. This is the cohesion of the water element. The third element is the fire element. Heat, or temperature, is the characteristic of the fire element. There are 4 aspects of the fire element in the body. The first type is the heat that warms up the body. You feel hot because this heat is flowing well, and you feel cold when it is not. This heat is neither you nor I. It is only the function of the fire element. The second aspect is the heat that matures or ages the body. For example, your hair turns gray with age because of this aspect of the fire element. Those who have excessive fire element in the body have hair that turns gray easily. The third type is digestive heat, which digests what you consume, what you have eaten or drunk. This digestive heat is produced by our past karma. Because of some unwholesome past karma, in this life one may have poor digestive fire. The fourth type is the heat of fever. The fourth element is the wind element. It has pushing, supporting, and moving as its characteristics. The supporting action of the wind element keeps the body straight, and pushing makes the body bend and the hands flex and move. The body is made of these 4 elements. The earth element serves as the foundation for the other 3 elements. The body has coherence because of the water element, is maintained by the fire element, and is supported by the wind element. The body is only a group of elements. This is the reality of this body. Because of not knowing this truth as it really is, we regard the body as I, mine, and myself. Thus one clings to the idea of a permanent body that can be relied upon. To develop knowledge of the body as it really is, keep contemplating the 4 elements, either through the detailed way or the brief way, one after another, from the top of the head down to the soles of the feet, repeatedly. When you feel the hardness of the whole body, know that it is the earth element. When you feel that the body has coherence, know that it is the water element. When you feel the bodily temperature, know it is the fire element. And when you feel the supporting force that maintains your posture, No, that is the wind element. Hardness, cohesion, heat, and supporting are just characteristics of the respective elements, not I, not myself. Without contemplating the body in this way, it is difficult to realize the non-self nature of the body. You need to discern four elements repeatedly until knowledge arises. When concentration deepens, the body turns out to be bubbling with no solidity at all. Some meditators, through the power of concentration and by seeing the four elements again and again throughout the body, see the elements break into millions of particles, vibrating, arising, and passing away incessantly. On repeatedly seeing these uncontrollable phenomena arising and passing away, one realizes the solidity of the body is just an illusion. Previously, one was so enchanted with the body, thinking that it is real, fit, and beautiful. Now, through correct seeing, one is awakened, and the body is seen as just particles coming together and falling apart repeatedly. The view of the body as I, mine, myself, can no longer be maintained. Because of this direct experience, one knows there is nothing in the body one can hold on to. One starts to let go of the belief that the body can be relied upon for happiness. Letting go has to be achieved by seeing rightly, grounded upon one's practical experience. From time to time, the elements go out of balance. At these times, the four elements are like four poisonous snakes. Earth element can be compared to an earth snake. If the hardness in the body becomes excessive, we feel stiff and rigid, and mobility becomes difficult. At that time, we feel like we have been bitten by the earth snake. Excessive hardness can cause death as well. We have to take care of this poisonous snake by exercising the body. If the water element is in excess, what will happen to the body? Excessive water element may cause swelling and diarrhea. At that moment, one is bitten by the water snake. When the body is overheated or when one has a fever, one is attacked by the fire snake. This fire snake is very dangerous and may cause death. It is important to take care of the fire snake properly. If the wind element is insufficient in the body, one may get a stroke, and the body cannot move well. Excessive wind causes belching and bloating in the stomach. At these times, the wind snake is furious. Thus, the Buddha compared the four elements to four dangerous poisonous snakes. It's important to learn what causes imbalance of the body. There are four causes: food, temperature, karma, and mind. When extremely spicy food is swallowed, the heat of the body becomes excessive. One has to balance it by taking more cooling food. When the weather is too hot or too cold, the body also loses its balance. Negativity of mind also can cause imbalance of the elements. For example, when one gets angry, excessive heat will be produced in the body, causing the fire element to go out of balance. When the body is ill, most people cling to the body and think, "I'm sick." Owing to the grasping, the illness becomes even worse. But if one can cultivate equanimity toward whatever happens in the body, even if the body is sick, the mind is unmoved. The state of equanimity produces pure energy that heals the body. This is what we call matter born of mind. Our past karma will also affect the body. The Buddha many times was afflicted with back pain. This was because in one of his past lives he was a wrestler. He used to break the opponent's backbones. Because of this bad karma, the Buddha had to suffer back pain as a karmic result. Whatever pain arises in the body, just know it as an imbalance of the elements. Don't cling to the pain as my pain. See hardness, heat, vibration, stiffness, etc. as elements. They are not my hardness, my heat, etc. This way of contemplation helps one to let go of the clinging and helps to remove the perception of self. All suffering comes from clinging to the self, which is just an illusion. When one disidentifies self from the body, one's mind becomes at ease and free. One should also extend the knowledge of the four elements to external bodies. Thus one can contemplate, for example, the body of one's beloved or of a person one hates. People are attracted to their loved ones and dislike those they hate because they do not understand that their bodies are also just a group of elements. We have to contemplate internally as well as externally to get rid of the likes and dislikes. How do we discern externally? When we realize that our body is composed of these impersonal four elements, we can project this understanding to an external person, especially to those one hates or loves. Which elements do you hate or love? Earth, water, fire, or wind? By investigating in this way, one loses the perception of a being or a person. Finding that no one is there, one further abandons the obsessive emotions of lust and aversion. If you have craving for and are clinging to inanimate things such as cars, jewelry, a big house, clothing, etc., contemplate them as the four elements to stop clinging to them. They are, in fact, composed of four elements, are they not? Practice in this way to develop detachment to people and things. All suffering comes from clinging and self-identification. When suffering arises, investigate the causes of your suffering. Work to remove the cause. When the cause is removed, the effect, suffering, will cease. By seeing the four elements in the body internally and externally without a maker, experiencer, abider, and actor, a yogi is immersed in voidness. The five aggregates. Now we come to the five murderers. The five murderers are the five aggregates of clinging. The materiality aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the formations aggregate, and the consciousness aggregate. What is the materiality aggregate of clinging? There are four primary elements and 24 types of derived materiality. Four elements times six senses. The 24 types of derived materiality include the sensitivity of eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body with their respective objects of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tangible objects. The materiality aggregate is the body in the conventional sense. The second aggregate is the feeling aggregate. In Buddhism, the word feeling is much more specific than the standard English definition, which is synonymous with emotion. The word feeling in the context of the aggregates means only the mental feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Emotions belong to the fourth aggregate discussed below. We cling to feelings even more so than to the body. When the eyes see a sensually enticing object, pleasant eye contact occurs and a pleasant feeling arises. If one is not aware of that pleasant feeling and does not understand its impermanence, craving is sure to follow. When the visible object is unpleasant, unpleasant feeling arises, which activates the latent tendency of aversion. Feelings arise beyond our control. We cannot prevent a feeling from arising, but we can be aware of it. Feeling is just a mental state, and it is conditional. It comes and goes. What is conditional and changing cannot be regarded as a permanent self. Without awareness of what is happening at the moment of sense contact, that feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, are born of the six contacts of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The mind is beset by greed, hatred, and delusion, and there's no way to liberation. Craving follows after pleasant feeling. If that craving is left unchecked, the force intensifies and becomes clinging. Thus, it is said that dependent on craving, grasping comes to be. Grasping means holding on tightly to what one desires. At this point, the mind becomes very agitated and enslaved because of the sensual urge. In order to satiate the intense craving, the body has to act. That action, whether it is wholesome or unwholesome, is called karma process becoming, because it paves the way to rebirth. Thus, dependent on clinging, karma process becoming arises. When that particular karma ripens, rebirth arises. Dependent on birth, there arises aging, sickness, and death. Thus arises the whole mass of suffering. Therefore, the feeling aggregate is like a murderer who triggers the vicious reactions that fuel the continuous cycle of rebirths. It's very important to stop feeling before it turns to craving. Because craving arises owing to feeling, we have to learn to be aware of feeling first. Since feelings arise all the time, mindfulness is to be extended continuously throughout the day. When pleasant feeling arises, we first become aware of its presence, then understand its characteristic of being felt, its function of experiencing the desirable aspect of the agreeable object, and its manifestation of relishing the object and pleasing both mind and body. By understanding a feeling's individual essence, one does not grasp that feeling as oneself. Further, one contemplates pleasant feeling as a formed, conditional, and dependently arisen state. Look upon the arising feeling dispassionately. One can see the feeling as fleeting, as foreign, as a third party, as empty or devoid of self. The Buddha repeatedly said, "Whatever feeling one has is impermanent and subject to destruction." If we have this understanding, feelings lose their power to activate the underlying tendency of craving. Sense contact causes pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feeling to arise. Since sense contact occurs all the time, feelings are also arising all the time at tremendous speed, but our mindfulness is relatively slow and sluggish. So we become entangled and tenaciously hold on to feeling. Even if we remember to be aware of feeling, identity view immediately identifies feeling as I, as myself. This enhances the ego illusion. If feeling were actually ours, we could exercise controlling power to have only pleasant feeling, but feeling does not succumb to our command. Feeling is a mental state that has the function of experiencing the desirable and undesirable nature of an object at the very moment of sense contact, and it immediately falls away and re-arises. To rise and fall incessantly is the nature of all compounded phenomena. When due to ignorance, we are unable to break down the compactness of continuity of this incessant stream of feelings through alert mindfulness and wisdom, we assume that feeling is a unity, that it has a core, or that it is an entity within its experiencer. But feeling is not I or myself. Seeing feeling as such is the correct seeing. The third aggregate is the perception aggregate. Perception perceives the qualities of an object and makes a sign regarding those qualities so these qualities can be recognized or perceived again in the future. For example, the first time an elephant is seen, one notices a trunk, long curved ivory tusks, and large ears. The trunk, long curved ivory tusks, and large ears become conditions for recognizing an elephant when it is seen again. The experience of the six chords of sensual pleasure leaves its happy impression on the heart. Because that happy impression is noted or memorized by perception, we long for the enjoyment of the six chords of sensual pleasure again. But in fact, every experience is new. If perception perceives the misery and the danger of sensual pleasure, the mind will not long for the enjoyment of sensual pleasure. It is common that when one perceives, the mind starts to proliferate and to become engaged. Perception also takes what is wrong to be right. Owing to perverted or distorted perception, humans perceive phenomena that arise to be permanent, to be happiness, and to be a self. Once a phenomenon is perceived in a distorted manner, the misperception is imprinted deeply in the mind and becomes very difficult to correct. Perverted perception causes wrong thinking. Wrong thinking causes grasping. The fourth aggregate is the aggregate of formations. Its characteristic is the forming, fabricating, and constructing that accumulates karma. One of the formations, volition, specifically, is called karma. For example, when a man has the volition to kill in mind, following that intention, he performs the unskillful karma of killing that paves the way to an unhappy rebirth in the future. On the other hand, when he has the volition to abstain from killing, he forms the good karma of abstaining from killing that paves the way to a happy rebirth in the future. When one practices mindfulness of breathing, this forms a wholesome mental karma because at the time the mind is secluded from sensual clinging. However, such good karma still leads to becoming. Why? Because the latent defilement of ignorance blinds us to think that the mind that is aware of the breath is a self. The latent defilement of craving makes the mind delight in the existence of both the breath and the knowing mind itself, which is craving for existence. Latent ignorance and craving are the two root causes that bring renewed existence, in this case, a happy existence. The formation's aggregate constructs many wholesome and unwholesome mental factors, such as happiness, mindfulness, concentration, effort, wisdom, equanimity, faith, shame of wrongdoing, lust, aversion, conceit, covetousness, jealousy, wrong view, etc. The arising of these wholesome and unwholesome mental factors causes one to perform corresponding skillful and unskillful karmas accordingly. The untrained mind simply takes these mental factors as I and mine and gets caught in ego illusion. Every wholesome and unwholesome karma performed feeds the ego constantly until it becomes as stable as if it were a permanent and enduring self. When this self becomes unmanageable, like an entangled ball of thread, disentangling it becomes extremely difficult. In short, the formation's aggregate, with volition as its leader, is responsible for all karmas performed. Wholesome and unwholesome formations once in existence leave behind a karmic tendency that will produce a new birth when it meets with favorable conditions. Where there is birth, aging, and death follow. Thus, the formation's aggregate is also a murderer who kills us in the cycle of death and rebirth. The fifth aggregate is the aggregate of consciousness. There are six types of consciousness: ear, eye, nose, tongue, body, and mind consciousness. The characteristic of consciousness is to know or cognize the object. With the arising of an object, consciousness arises simultaneously to cognize the object. This occurs at a tremendous speed and with seeming continuity. During this process, it seems as if an enduring being is experiencing phenomena. The truth of impermanence is hidden by the compactness of this apparent continuity. Consciousness is actually arising and passing away very rapidly in succession, but we are unable to break down this seeming continuity of consciousness, and we mistake it for an enduring self. When the eye comes into contact with visible objects, with attention, eye consciousness arises, seeing form. If internally the eye is intact, but no external forms come into its range, and there is no corresponding consciousness engagement, then there is no manifestation of the corresponding consciousness. If internally the eye is intact and external forms come into its range, and yet there is no attention paid to the object, then there, again, is no manifestation of the corresponding consciousness. If we are unable to understand the causal relationship of eye, visible object, attention, and eye consciousness, we think it is I who sees. If eye consciousness were I, when the eye sensitivity and the visible objects vanish, the so-called I also vanishes. From seeing, mind consciousness starts to recollect, ponder, and examine what has been seen. We further cling to and identify with what we recollect, ponder, and examine as mine and myself, and thus fall prey to craving and identity view. Thought is empty by itself. It is projected by our past perception and view. If the mind stays always in the now, the present moment, we can easily see thought arising and passing without entity. It is through our holding on to thought that it seems real and substantial. Thinking the thought is real, we further react physically and verbally to the seemingly real thought. Empty the mind of both identity view and craving, and the mind will perceive the imperceptible. The five aggregates were compared to murderers. In the Yamaka Sutta, Venerable Sariputta gave a simile. He said, "Friend, suppose there was a rich man with much wealth and property, protected by bodyguards. Then someone appeared who wanted to ruin him, to harm him, to endanger him, and to take his life. It occurred to the man that this rich man was protected by bodyguards, and it wouldn't be easy to take his life by force. He thought, 'Let me get close to him and then take his life.' Then he approached the rich man and said to him, 'I would like to serve you, sir.' The rich man appointed him as a servant. The man served the rich man very well, rising up before him, retiring after him, doing whatever he wanted. He was agreeable in his conduct and endearing in his speech. Eventually, the rich man considered him a friend and placed trust in him. However, when the man became aware that the rich man had placed trust in him, finding him alone, he took his life with a sharp knife. When the man was serving the rich man, rising up before him, retiring after him, doing whatever he wanted, agreeable in his conduct, endearing in his speech, wasn't he a murderer then, even though the others might not recognize him as a murderer?" Our five aggregates are compared to a murderer living closely with us, though we may not recognize him. Our five aggregates serve us and please us well. We become very intimate with our five aggregates and place trust in our five aggregates. When clinging to the five aggregates grows strong, we will then be killed. These five aggregates are subject to clinging, and we cling to them firmly with identity view. Buddha said, "Suppose, bhikkhus, a dog tied up on a leash was bound to a strong post or pillar. If it walks close to that post or pillar. If it stands close to that post or pillar. If it sits down close to that post or pillar. If it lies down close to that post or pillar." So too, bhikkhus, the uninstructed worldling regards form thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. He regards feeling, perception, formations, consciousness thus. This is mine, this I am, this is myself. If he walks close to those five aggregates subject to clinging. If he stands close to those five aggregates subject to clinging. If he sits down close to those five aggregates subject to clinging. If he lies down close to those five aggregates subject to clinging. The danger of the five aggregates is that they are impermanent, transient, and not a self. This must be thoroughly known so that letting go of clinging to them becomes possible. If these five aggregates are wrongly grasped by consciousness as permanent, as happiness, and as self, consciousness becomes dependent on them. When consciousness becomes dependent, the future five aggregates are built up. When the future five aggregates are built up, aging, sickness, death, lamentation, sorrow, pain, and despair follow. One is not free from suffering. Now we turn to craving. The sixth murderer with drawn sword is our intimate companion. Who is the intimate companion who stays with us all the time? It is craving, the enemy who pretends to be a friend. Craving is always with us in our daily life. Whether we are eating, bathing, seeing an agreeable object, listening to music, engaging in sport, laughing, touching a loved one, thinking, or fantasizing. We eat not only to ease hunger, but to satiate craving. If this were not so, obesity would not have become a syndrome of modern society. Craving is the incentive for all our actions. Without the element of craving, what we do seems monotonous and lifeless. Craving is a motivator that keeps us running from one sensual object to the other without weariness. We crave not only for pleasing and delightful sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and sensations, but also for wealth, social status, companionship, recognition, gain, and fame. And we spend our entire life running here and there in pursuit of them, thinking they are intimate friends providing us real security and happiness. Our limited mind regards them as the only happiness worth pursuing. Nothing else can give us happiness. Because the mind is so engrossed in acquiring this type of happiness, we forget that there is another type of happiness, the happiness of not having, the happiness of contentment. When there is gain, there is loss. Calling nothing one's own, one achieves freedom of the heart. Furthermore, craving is insatiable. The more you get, the more you want. It is the origin of all suffering. Craving pretends to be a good friend, pleasing us in every aspect. But it is really an enemy with a raised sword who is inflicting pain on us and cuts off our life when we get intimate with him. Craving is stimulated by pleasant feelings, and pleasant feelings are derived from agreeable and delightful sense contact. Our senses are open to the impingement of sense contact as long as we are conscious. The Buddha likened the experience of contact to the plight of a flayed cow. Wherever it stands, it is nibbled at by the creatures dwelling there, whether against a wall, against a tree, or in water. We are nearly as helpless as we stand exposed to constant excitation by the six kinds of contact burdening us with agitation and restlessness. The pleasing and agreeable sense contact is called a thorn in Buddha's discipline. Suppose you enter a thorny forest. There would be thorns in front of you, thorns behind you, thorns to your left, thorns to your right, thorns below you, and thorns above you. How can you protect yourself so as not to be pricked by a thorn? You would probably go forward mindfully and go back mindfully, thinking, "May no thorn prick me." Another type of craving is the underlying tendency of craving for life that brings us into this world. In the past, influenced by ignorance and thinking life is joyful, we performed various skillful actions with the hope to get a better rebirth. Those actions left behind karmic energy in our mental stream. We were born here as a result of the maturing of one of those particular karmas. In the present life, owing to the element of craving, we continue to long for future rebirth, regardless of life's painful experiences. The six sense bases and six sense objects. In the sutta, the man reaches an empty village with only six houses, and whatever house he enters is void, deserted, empty. The houses are the designation for the six sense bases. If a wise, competent, intelligent person examines the eye appears to be void, hollow, empty. The same is true for the other five sense bases. So long as the six external sense objects do not impinge on the six sense bases, they remain empty and void, unable to function. The village attacking robbers represent the six external sense objects, forms, sounds, smells, tastes, tangible objects, and mental objects. The six sense objects are reckoned as the six village attacking robbers because they raid the six sense bases, resulting in like and dislike, greed and hate. When an agreeable or sensually enticing form impinges on the eye, the body and mind become excited and thrilled with sensual lust. At this point, the village attacking robber has raided our peace and composure, inflaming us with the fire of lust. If this sensual lust is unfulfilled, one becomes very agitated and restless. However, when a disagreeable form impinges on the eye, the mind becomes dismayed and wants to turn away, and the body becomes hot and agitated. Again, the village attacking robber has raided our peace and composure, inflaming us with the fire of aversion. We feel horrible, as if we were being punished by our unskillful thought. When a neutral form impinges on the eye, neutral feeling arises. Again, the village attacking robber has raided our peace and composure, inflaming us with the fire of ignorance. One wrongly thinks that one has no feeling at all and ends up in confusion and bewilderment. We react in the same manner throughout life whenever agreeable, disagreeable, and neutral sounds, smells, tastes, tangible objects, and mental objects impinge on the ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. The village attacking robbers raid the peace of our mind through the six sense bases. How does one avoid the assault of these robbers? Buddha gave the answer through his advice to Bahaya. Then, Bahaya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When, for you, there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then, Bahaya, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. What Buddha intended to say was, do not conceive of oneself seeing, hearing, sensing, and cognizing. If one conceives there is a self who sees, hears, senses, and cognizes, the mind proliferates with craving and identity view, and actions will follow. The abandonment of craving and identity view can be accomplished by strong mindfulness and penetrative wisdom when the sense impression comes in contact with the sense door. Mindfulness is the front gate through which one knows what is happening right now, and wisdom penetrates what is seen, heard, sensed, and cognized as simply a cause-effect relationship, an interplay between materiality and consciousness. This cause and effect relationship has no controlling entity behind it. Another way to avoid the assault of these village attacking robbers is by guarding the sense faculties so that defilements will not gain access through the sense bases. The ways to guard one's sense faculties are 1. Clear comprehension of posture. One focuses on one's concentration object, such as one's in and out breath, in all postures, so that defilements have no chance to arise. 2. Clear comprehension of non-delusion. One keeps contemplating the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and non-self in what is seen, heard, smelled, tasted, sensed, and cognized. It is important to bear in mind that neither the six sense objects nor the six sense bases are each other's fetters, but rather it is the desire and lust that arise in dependence on both that are the fetters. If the six sense objects were the fetter of the six sense bases, or if the six sense bases were the fetter of the six sense objects, the living of the holy life could not be fulfilled for the complete destruction of suffering. This is because as long as one has the six sense bases, one would always be fettered by the six sense objects. Identity view. After fleeing in one direction and then in another, the man in the sutta comes to a great expanse of water. The near shore is dangerous and frightening, and the farther shore is safe and free from danger. The near shore is identity view. This view wrongly regards the five aggregates as a permanent, unchanging self. In other words, when one assumes that either one or all of the five aggregates are the self, that the self possesses five aggregates, that the five aggregates are in the self, or the self is in the five aggregates, identity view comes about. Where identity view regards the five aggregates as mine, I, and my permanent self. With this identity view, one cannot free oneself from suffering. Suppose there were a river, a mountain torrent, a swift flowing stream that goes a long way. On both its banks, there might be growing kasa grass that overhangs, kusa grass that overhangs, babaja grass that overhangs, and trees that overhang. A man being swept away by that stream might clutch at the kasa grass, but they might break away, and owing to that, he would come to grief. He might clutch at the kusa grass, he might clutch at the babaja grass, he might clutch at the trees, but they too break away, and owing to that, he would come to grief. Similarly, If anyone grasps form as self, thinking it is firm, secure, and has a core, when his form disintegrates, he might come to grief. If he grasps the pleasant feeling, when his pleasant feeling changes, when he grasps the perception of happiness, when the perception of happiness turns out to be elusive. If he grasps the formations, if the formations are not fulfilled. If he grasps the consciousness, when that consciousness turns out to be like a magician's trick cheating him, owing to that he might come to grief. A swift flowing stream is just like our life, ongoing and forever changing. It appears very insecure to most of us if there is no entity to hold on to. We helplessly grasp form, feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness to make us feel secure, stable, and permanent, though the five aggregates are all the time disintegrating. In addition to these internal five aggregates, we grasp the external five aggregates, the aggregates of our loved ones. If the internal five aggregates are themselves fragile, insubstantial, and beyond our control, trying to grasp the external five aggregates is none other than the most futile action. As it's said in the Dhammapada, "Sons have I, wealth have I, thus a fool frets and fusses. Verily, oneself does not exist. Whence, sons, whence wealth?" There are two ways one can free oneself from identity view. The first is to investigate dependently arising states. The dependent origination formula says, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. Nothing arises without causes. On investigation, the cause of each arising physical and mental aggregate reveals itself. The form aggregate arises dependent upon karma, consciousness, temperature, and food. The consciousness aggregate arises dependent on name and form. The aggregates of feeling, perception, and formations arise dependent on contact. Once these causes are seen, their non-self nature becomes evident. The second is the resolution of the five aggregates into their individual essence in terms of their characteristic and function. Each aggregate has its characteristic and function. For example, we have learned that perception has the characteristic of perceiving the special quality of an object. The function of perception is to recognize what has been perceived. So when our eyes perceive color or different beautiful visible objects, knowledge knows that this is the work of perception, not a self. Identity view is the main culprit responsible for throwing us into woeful states. As long as identity view is not permanently uprooted from our mental stream, our lives will always tend to move toward rebirth in the four woeful states. To be able to escape from such a rebirth, one must free oneself from identity view. How? When performing an evil deed, most people firmly hold on to the thought, "I have done wrong. I have made a grave mistake." We delusively transform that evil deed into a self, atta, and become greatly distressed by such firmly held thoughts. Such attachment to the thought of I as "I have made a huge mistake" makes the karma potent enough to produce a future unhappy existence. When stream entry path and fruition are realized, identity view is extinguished, and the gate to be reborn in the four woeful states is closed. How is it that the innumerable unwholesome karmic actions of the past can become inoperative? Ledi Sayadaw, a well-known scholar monk from Myanmar, gave the following illustration. In a string of beads, where a great number of beads are strung together by a strong silk thread, if one bead is pulled, all the others will follow that one that is pulled. But if the silk thread is cut or removed, pulling one of the beads will not disturb the other beads because there is no longer any string binding them together. Similarly, a being that possesses identity view harbors a strong attachment to the series of the aggregates arisen during past existences, and transforms them into an ego, thinking, in the past I have often been a human being, a deity, or a Brahma. He acquires the thread that is identity view. It is thus that the innumerable unwholesome karmic actions of the past, which have not yet produced results, will accompany that being wherever he may be reborn. These unwholesome actions of the past resemble beads that are strung and bound together by a strong thread. Beings, however, who clearly perceive the characteristic of not-self and have rid themselves of identity view will perceive that the physical and mental aggregates that arise and disappear even within the short period of one sitting do so as separate phenomena and not as a closely interlinked continuum. The concept of myself, which is like the thread, is no longer present. Those physical and mental processes appear to them like the beads from which the thread has been removed. They clearly perceive that the unwholesome actions of the past committed by them are not persons nor beings, not an I nor my actions, but that they arise and disappear in an instant. That is why past unwholesome karma disappears as soon as identity view disappears. The Four Floods. What is the great expanse of water that is so difficult for man to cross? This is the flood. There are four types of floods: the flood of sensuality, the flood of existence, the flood of view, and the flood of ignorance. They are floods because they are very difficult to cross and because they send beings to the ocean of samsara, the round of rebirth again and again. First is the flood of sensuality. Usually, sensuality refers to the enjoyment of the six external objects, pleasant visible objects, sounds, smells, tastes, tangible objects, and mental objects, together with the six internal bases. This sensuality becomes a flood because it overwhelms and hinders. I would like to give an example from the shorter discourse on the destruction of craving. One day, Sakka, ruler of the heaven of the 33 gods, who is a stream enterer, went to the Buddha and, after paying homage to him, stood at one side and asked, "Venerable sir, how, in brief, is a bhikkhu liberated by the destruction of craving, one who has reached the ultimate end, the ultimate security from bondage, the ultimate holy life, the ultimate goal, one who is foremost among gods and humans?" Buddha gave a brief answer. He said, "When a bhikkhu has heard that nothing is worth adhering to, he directly knows everything. Having directly known everything, he fully understands everything. Having fully understood everything, whatever feeling he feels, whatever pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he abides, contemplating impermanence in those feelings, contemplating fading away, contemplating cessation, contemplating relinquishment. Contemplating thus, he does not cling to anything in the world. When he does not cling, he does not get agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana." Then Sakka, ruler of gods, delighting and rejoicing in the Blessed One's words, paid homage to the Blessed One, and he vanished at once. Venerable Magdalena, who was sitting not far from the Blessed One, considered whether Sakka had penetrated the meaning of the Blessed One's words when he rejoiced. Intending to find out the answer, Venerable Magdalena, who was foremost in supernatural power, vanished from this world and appeared among the gods ruled by Sakka. Now, on that occasion, Sakka was furnished and endowed 100-fold with the 5 kinds of heavenly music, and he was enjoying it in the pleasure park. When he saw the Venerable Magdalena coming in the distance, he dismissed the music and welcomed him. Venerable Magdalena asked Sakka to repeat what he had just learned from the Buddha, so that he might also get to hear that statement. Sakka felt very embarrassed because he could not remember, although he tried hard to recall what the Buddha had said. Sakka tried to avoid answering the question by showing Venerable Magdalena the grandeur of his palace. Sakka boasted that it was owing to his great merit that he was able to build such a magnificent palace. Then the Venerable Moggallana considered thus, "This spirit is living much too negligently. What if I stirred up a sense of urgency in him?" Then the Venerable Moggallana performed a feat of supernormal power. By pointing his toe, he made the palace shake. Sakka was stirred to a sense of urgency with his hair standing on end, and the memory suddenly came back to him. He repeated what the Buddha had said to him. Venerable Moggallana was satisfied. The experience of Sakka shows that the flood of sensuality makes beings negligent. Once indulging in sensual pleasure, one easily forgets all wholesomeness. Even Sakka, who is a stream enterer, can forget the Dharma personally preached by the Buddha. How much easier would it be for an ordinary person to forget when indulging in sensual pleasure? One must be careful of the flood of sensual pleasures, which, like the vast ocean, is hard to cross. The second flood is the flood of existence, or becoming. As a result of the craving for life, many people want to come into this world again and again. For example, in my monastery in Myanmar, I had interviewed many meditators regarding their past life experiences. In their past lives, most meditators had offered food to monastics and wished to become a monk or a nun in a future life. This inclination toward another life, or the thought of conceiving I shall be, is the flood of becoming. There are five factors for rebirth: ignorance, craving, clinging, formations, and karma. For example, let's say someone who offers food to the monks prays to be born as a female in a Buddhist country in the next life. In this case, the offering is a wholesome formation. When this wholesome formation passes away, it leaves behind a karmic potency called karma. Praying to be reborn as a female is craving for life in a new existence. Intense craving for life as a female is clinging. I shall be is conceiving. Conceiving is a disease, a dart, and a cancer, as the mind inclines toward a future existence. When the mind inclines toward a future existence, the new five aggregates are built up. Ignorance is not knowing that female is just a heap of five aggregates in the ultimate sense. Wrong understanding causes strong craving, clinging, for life as a female. When this karma matures, it brings forth another life. So in this lifetime, one becomes what one prayed for. All of us, including non-returners, find the flood of existence difficult to cross. Even a non-returner may remain wishful to be reborn in a material or immaterial world. The third flood is the flood of view. There are many wrong views, such as wrong view of self, eternalism, annihilation, etc. In this world, many people engage in the wrong view of eternalism and the wrong view of annihilation. Eternalism maintains that the entirety of personal existence exists forever. Annihilationists claim that after death, the entirety of personal existence ends. Most Asians do not entertain the view of annihilation because they strongly believe in karma and rebirth. But many of them hold to the view of eternalism, wrongly believing that the same soul transmigrates from one life to another life, that it is the same person who takes rebirth. Why do we have this type of view? It's because we do not see with right understanding the constant cessation of formations dependent on conditions. We see only the arising of the four elements of feeling, perception, formations, and consciousness, without seeing their constant destruction, cessation, or passing away. Thus, the view of eternalism arises. Annihilationism claims that all mind and matter permanently cease at the time of death and have no continuation whatsoever in a new life. This view denies rebirth. A person who believes in the view of annihilation does not see with right understanding the constant arising of formations produced by causes. When we do not see the constant arising of phenomena, we think that after death, everything is annihilated. The Buddha said that these two views are too extreme, and that we should avoid these two views and walk the middle path. what is the middle path? One understands that dependent on ignorance, karma formations arise. Dependent on karmic formations, consciousness arises. Dependent on consciousness, mind and matter arise. Dependent on mind and matter, the six sense bases arise. Dependent on the six sense bases, contact arises. Dependent on contact, feeling arises. Dependent on feeling, craving arises. Dependent on craving, clinging arises. Dependent on clinging, becoming arises. Dependent on becoming, birth arises. Dependent on birth, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair arise. Thus arises this entire mass of suffering, dukkha. These 12 links of dependent origination are merely the process of causality. No one undergoes the process in the ultimate sense. This is right view. To thoroughly understand that there is no one undergoing the cycle of rebirth is extremely difficult, as we greatly attach to the concept of a permanent self. Another wrong view is not believing that actions produce results. One does not believe that good begets good and bad begets bad. One denies the workings of karma. What would happen to someone who does not believe in the workings of karma? That person would not be afraid of doing evil deeds and will not try to do good either, believing that such deeds would not bear fruit. Most Asians start the practice with an understanding of the right view of karma and its result, which says that we are the owner of our own karma, heir of our karma, born of our karma. Whatever karma we performed, whether good or bad, we are the heir. With this understanding, we try to avoid evil, cultivate the good, and purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. The fourth flood is the flood of ignorance, avidya. Ignorance means mental blindness or unknowing. Unknowing of what? Unknowing of the four noble truths. The noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. The Buddha said that because of not knowing or penetrating these four noble truths, we remain wandering repeatedly in the rounds of rebirth. The four noble truths. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. What is the noble truth of suffering? The five aggregates of clinging are the truth of suffering. Craving, or desire, lust, for the five aggregates is the second noble truth, the cause or origin of suffering. A person actually consists of five aggregates. But because we do not see this truth clearly, we are bound to conventional truth, which sees a person. Ultimately, there is no person or being, but five aggregates. The five aggregates are an ultimate truth. We use she, her, he, his, just for the sake of convenience. Why do the five aggregates arise again and again, extending onward through many lives? Because we crave for them. In delusion, we think they provide happiness. They do, but only in a transient and fleeting way. Unable to let go of desire for the five aggregates, we are bound. When the mind is bound with craving, the five aggregates reappear again. The five aggregates ultimately produce suffering. Why suffering? Because the aggregates do not yield to our wishes. They are beyond our control because they share the universal characteristic of impermanence. For example, we may want to have pleasant feeling, which is one of the five aggregates, all the time. However, unpleasant feelings creep in very often, even though the unpleasant feelings are not the feelings we wish for. We may wish that the body will be healthy always, but health often deteriorates. We want to cherish only positive thoughts. However, we find ourselves entangled in the negative emotions of agitation, worry, depression, fear, and doubt most of the time. We feel weary of what is beyond our control, which provides no guarantee of happiness. What we wish for cannot be fulfilled. That's why it's called suffering. There are also other types of suffering: the suffering of aging, death, dissociation from loved ones, association with the hated, etc. The third noble truth is the noble truth of cessation of suffering, nibbana. It is the cessation of the same cravings which bring forth repeated birth. The fourth truth, the path leading to the end of suffering, is the noble eightfold path. In the sutta, the man has now come to the near shore. In order to cross the great expanse of water and reach the far shore, he has to make a raft, the vehicle that will help him reach the safe place. What is this raft? The Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path. The first factor in the Noble Eightfold Path is right view. There are two types of right view: mundane vipassana right view and supramundane path right view. Mundane vipassana right view is repeatedly seeing the five aggregates as impermanent, subject to change, subject to destruction and fading away. Being constantly oppressed by arising and passing away, the five aggregates are painful and terrifying. What is impermanent and painful cannot be regarded as a permanent self. What is impermanent, painful, and not self is not something to delight in, and what is not something to delight in is not something for which one would arouse greed. Consequently, when the five aggregates both internally and externally are seen as impermanent, painful, and not self, then one becomes dispassionate toward the five aggregates. One does not delight in the five aggregates. The greed for the five aggregates fades away. When one does not inflame greed, one causes cessation of greed momentarily. This is mundane vipassana right view. As one progresses by seeing the unsatisfactoriness of what is formed again and again, one inclines one's mind toward nibbana, which is the opposite of the formed. When insight reaches its culmination, the supramundane path of stream entry arises, taking nibbana as its object. At this point, right view removes the ignorance that covers the Four Noble Truths. Thus, for the first time, one knows and sees the Four Noble Truths as they really are: the noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the origin of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the path that leads to the cessation of suffering, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. The second factor is right thought. Right thought means applying or directing thought correctly to thoughts of renunciation, non-ill will, and non-cruelty. We not only contemplate the danger of sensual pleasure to develop thoughts of renunciation, but we also try to renounce the concept that there is an I enjoying sensual pleasure. Renunciation also means letting go of ideas of who we are, what others think of us, or what we want to achieve: my house, my car, my loved one, my job, my salary, my social status. Such ideas grasp the notion of mine and enhance the craving for sensual pleasures even more. Entering jhana is also seen as a thought of renunciation, because when the mind is absorbed in jhana, thoughts of sensual pleasure are temporarily abandoned. As the Buddha said, when concentration is developed, mind is developed. When mind is developed, passion is removed. To remove thoughts of ill will, we contemplate thoughts of loving kindness. Because thoughts of ill will and thoughts of loving kindness are opposite in nature, they cannot arise at the same time. When thoughts of ill will arise in the mind, one immediately loses one's happiness. All beings spend their life seeking happiness and avoiding suffering. However, most think happiness comes from without, not from within. The path to real happiness seems to be lost. The wise know happiness comes from within, within the mind of unconditional love for others. To cultivate the right thought of non-cruelty, one contemplates the thought of compassion for all sentient beings. Compassion makes the heart quiver when one sees others in pain and misery. Desire arises to alleviate their pain. All beings wish to be free from all forms of suffering, yet despite these wishes, they continue to be troubled by fear, depression, bodily pain, grief, mental anguish, aging, sickness, and death. All these forms of suffering are indeed grounded in a self-cherishing attitude. The wise one knows. He cultivates the compassion that embraces the suffering of others. The thought of compassion is very powerful, as it works only for the benefit of others and completely forgets one's own benefit. When the mind is not grounded on the ego, it becomes fearless. These two factors, right view and right thought, constitute wisdom training. The third factor is right speech. There are four aspects to right speech: abstaining from false speech, abstaining from harsh speech, abstaining from backbiting, and abstaining from useless speech. If you abstain from these four, you have right speech. The fourth factor is right action, which consists of abstaining from killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. We abstain from these three actions not only to nurture a good mind, but also because of understanding the law of karma. Every action has its reaction. The reaction comes back directly to the actor himself. For example, the action of killing results in one having a short life. The fifth factor is right livelihood. For lay persons, there are only five livelihoods to abstain from. One should not deal in weapons, in intoxicants, in animals for slaughter, in poisons, or in selling of humans or slavery. We abstain from misconduct to protect ourselves. Our ultimate protection is our own morality, which is our internal protection. Only when we abstain from all unwholesome deeds do we protect our own life as well as the lives of others. Morality training is basic humanity. Right speech, right action, and right livelihood constitute morality training. This training helps us overcome our gross physical and verbal actions. The cause for the perfection of morality training lies in one's loving kindness and compassion for others. Morality training is the base for concentration training. Those who have morality training become fearless, free from self-reproach and remorse, and free from the reproach of others. They have self-confidence and serenity of mind. This is conducive to developing concentration. The sixth factor is right effort. Many people think that right effort consists of sitting in meditation for a long time and enduring pain without changing posture. But that's only physical right effort. There are four types of right effort: effort to prevent unarisen evil from arising, effort to discard evil that has arisen, effort to arouse wholesome states that have not yet arisen, and effort to bring to perfection wholesome states that have already arisen. The most effective way to prevent evil from arising is to guard the sense doors. All defilements come through the sense doors of the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Sensually enticing objects mostly come through the eye door. Abusive words or praise come through the ear door. Sweet tastes come through the tongue door. Pleasant touch through the body door, etc. How does one guard the sense doors? This is done either by fixing one's mind on concentration objects such as one's breath or whatever technique one follows, or by being mindful of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, sensing, and thinking. Mindfulness not only cuts down discursive thoughts regarding the present objects, but also either prevents the mind from falling into past pleasant sensual experiences or longing for pleasant sensual experiences that have not yet occurred. Mindfulness takes in the actual characteristics of the cognized objects and allows wisdom to understand the impermanence of all phenomena. If evil thoughts have arisen, it is very important at that time to have right effort to discard them. Most people do not have this type of effort. They allow the negative emotions of anger, lust, fear, craving, jealousy, cruelty, etc. to overwhelm them. Being overwhelmed by these unskillful mental states, they act compulsively, either finding fault in others or beating themselves up. They become the victims of their defilements. Any such action will only hurt oneself and others. Later, when those negative emotions have gone, they may feel remorse over their actions to the extent of developing self-hatred. The vicious cycle goes on when one has no right effort to discard evil that has arisen. Buddha, when still an unenlightened bodhisattva, related how he subdued the arising fear and dread through right effort. He said, "While I walked, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither stood nor sat nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I stood, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor sat nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I sat, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor stood nor lay down till I had subdued that fear and dread. While I lay down, the fear and dread came upon me. I neither walked nor stood nor sat down till I had subdued that fear and dread." Without right effort, one cannot free oneself from suffering. Therefore, the effort to discard, dispel, and remove evil thoughts that have arisen in the mind at the very moment they arise is crucial. When the defilements are left unchecked and uncontrolled, the defilements gain momentum and become extremely difficult to overcome. The force is further reinforced and becomes our second nature. In the discourse on the removal of distracting thoughts, the Buddha describes 5 ways to remove evil thoughts that have already arisen. 1. When wholesome thoughts connected with greed, hatred, and delusion arise, one should give attention to the opposite mental state connected with the wholesome. For example, when thoughts of hatred arise toward persons whom we do not like, a traditional way is to replace anger with thoughts of loving kindness, wishing others to be well, happy, and peaceful until the thought of anger subsides. This may prove difficult for many people because of lack of mastery over the mind. If thoughts of loving kindness fail, there are other ways to overcome anger. One can try to contemplate separating the object of anger into 32 parts. How? When one is angry with someone, what is it one is angry with? Is it the person's head hairs one is angry with, or bones, or snot? Or is it the person's feces one is angry with? Alternatively, one can develop understanding of the body of the enemy as composed of the 4 elements, earth, water, fire, and wind. Is it the earth element in his body that one is angry with, or the water element, or the fire element, or the wind element? If one can regard the object of one's anger in terms of the 32 parts or the 4 elements, and see that the object is not a being or a person, one's anger gains no foothold, like a painting in the air. 2. If, however, one fails to achieve the objective by using this method, and unwholesome thoughts connected with greed, hatred, and delusion are still present in the mind, one can examine the danger in these thoughts. These thoughts are unwholesome. They are reprehensible and are productive of painful results for unaccountable lifetimes according to the law of karma. For example, when getting angry, one should reproach oneself thus: "By getting angry, am I not like a man who wants to hit another and instead picks up a burning ember or piece of excrement, and by doing so first burns himself or makes himself stink? Or when the mind tenaciously grasps the sensually enticing form, one tries to remember what the Buddha said: 'For if mind should stand tied to gratification in the delightful sign of form, and if one should die on that occasion, it is possible that one will go to hell or the animal realm.'" 3. If unwholesome thoughts continue to dominate the mind, one can try to forget and ignore these thoughts and not pay any attention to them by diverting one's attention to another matter. In meditation, sometimes we ignore discursive thoughts, and even physical pain can be ignored if we can focus on the breath intensively. Without reflecting and dwelling on discursive thought, the force of it will gradually diminish and our mind will not be bothered. 4. If, however, unwholesome thoughts still do not subside, one can inquire into the cause of those unwholesome thoughts. For example, when abusive words contact your ear, you feel angry. After the abusive words subside, you still hold the bitter feeling, although there is no more ear contact. Why is it so? If you can inquire into the cause, you will realize it is because we cling to and identify with the unpleasant feeling as I or myself. Then let go of that cause of suffering, clinging, and identification. 5. If unwholesome thoughts still linger in the mind, the Buddha gave the following advice. With teeth clenched and the tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, one should beat down, constrain, and crush the unwholesome mind with the wholesome mind. If one still fails to remove distracting thoughts of lust and hate, here I would suggest that you be mindful of or make a mental note of your mental states, seeing a mind affected by anger as a mind affected by anger, a mind affected by lust as a mind affected by lust. Do this 1,000 times to the extent necessary for you to see that there is only mind, without the perception of self. The clinging to and the identification with the defilements as myself is the greatest suffering that binds us. If the distracting thoughts of lust and hate have been dispelled, do not look on with indifference when they arise a second time. Dispel them even if they arise 100 times. Act so that no signs shall remain. Persistent effort is needed here. Let us return to the third type of right effort, the effort to arouse a wholesome state that is not yet arisen. Those who have not undertaken morality training should arouse the effort to do so by understanding its value. One must also arouse effort to practice concentration if one has not yet made any initial effort. Similarly, one should arouse effort to practice insight if one has not yet attempted to do so. The fourth type of right effort is the effort to develop and bring to perfection a wholesome state that has already arisen. This final effort is necessary to perfect our morality, to attain jhana, and to experience different stages of insight, especially to see the arising and passing away of the 5 aggregates until the mind becomes disenchanted and finally liberated by not clinging to them. The 7th factor is right mindfulness. It is remembering, or not forgetting, to practice the 4 foundations of mindfulness: contemplation of the body, contemplation of the different types of feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, contemplation of different states of the mind, such as lustful mind, angry mind, contracted mind, distracted mind, etc., and contemplation of mental qualities, dharmas, such as the 5 hindrances, the 4 noble truths, the 7 factors of enlightenment, etc. Body, feeling, mind, and mental qualities serve as the foundations for the establishment of mindfulness, which arouses in us the wisdom to know body as body, feeling as feeling, mind as mind, and mental qualities as mental qualities. No abider, maker, originator, or experiencer can be found in them, only the ongoing process of cognition. And this process of cognition arises with causes and ceases when the causes cease. The 8th factor is right concentration. It is collecting or unifying the mind, which means cultivating a state where all mental factors are brought together and intensified by directing them onto one particular object, such as the breath, continuously for a designated period of time. At this time, the mind is quite secluded from sensual pleasures and from the 5 hindrances, and is accompanied by applied and sustained application of mind, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. This is abiding in the first jhana. Right concentration means the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th jhanas. To attain 2nd jhana, one removes applied and sustained application of mind, while rapture and pleasure born of concentration remain. To reach 3rd jhana, one does away with rapture, leaving happiness and one-pointedness. Finally, with the abandoning of pleasure and pain, and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, one enters the 4th jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. Concentration makes the mind wieldy, malleable, and luminous. At such a time, if one directs one's mind to see one's own five aggregates as well as the external five aggregates of others, the nature of the five aggregates will appear as arising and vanishing constantly. Being oppressed by the constant arising and passing away, one feels weary and gets disenchanted by the whole process. One further understands the emptiness of the process. How can the process of constant arising and passing away have an enduring self? Therefore, the Buddha repeatedly said, "Develop concentration. One with concentration sees things as they really are." Right effort, mindfulness, and concentration together are known as the concentration training. While practicing mindfulness of breathing, one puts forth effort to be mindful of one's breath. When attention lapses, one tries to bring the mind back to the breath again and again. Because of repeated effort, the mind constantly stays with the breath. One does not forget the breath. Without forgetting the breath, mindfulness sinks into it. With application of effort and mindfulness in this way, one's mind gradually anchors and unifies on the breath and attains deep concentration. Working together in this way, right effort, mindfulness, and concentration fulfill the concentration training. These three trainings, training in morality, concentration, and wisdom, are the same as the Noble Eightfold Path. This Noble Eightfold Path is the raft that can help you cross the great expanse of water and reach the far shore, Nibbana. Although this path is fulfilling, for most people the journey is very painful, like that of a snake shedding its dead skin. This is because the path of these three trainings goes against our habitual pattern of behavior ingrained in us for such a long time. It is the path of constantly letting go of our belief, value, culture, view, craving, aversion, vanity, cleverness, etc. And the path, although it leads us to the far shore, is for treading, not for grasping. Therefore, having found the raft, one still needs to apply effort to row the raft. In the sutta, the man, by means of that raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, safely crossed to the far shore. Making effort with hands and feet, this is a designation for the arousing of energy. The energy includes initial energy, intermediate energy, and persistent energy until the goal is achieved. The story of Venerable Tissa will make clear these three types of energy. Tissa, the head of a family at Savatthi, after listening to the teaching of the Buddha, made use of initial energy to renounce his immense wealth and become a homeless one. He dwelled in the forest, practicing meditation relentlessly in solitude. This was his intermediate energy. His sister-in-law, worried that he might disrobe and take back the wealth, sent a band of 500 robbers to kill him. The robbers, after entering the forest and searching for the elder, in due course came to the place in which he lived and sat around him. The elder spoke thus, "Lay disciples, why have you come?" They replied, "To kill you." Then the elder said, "I will give you my promise. Give me my life for just this one night." Said the robbers, "O recluse, who will guarantee that you will stay in a place like this?" The elder, thereupon, took a big stone and broke the bones of his legs. Enduring his pain, he said, "Lay disciples, is this the assurance you need?" They, inspired by the elder's courage, leaving him alone, went to the end of the pathway and, lighting a fire, lay on the ground. The elder contemplated on the purity of his conduct, arousing tireless energy. After suppressing his pain, persistent in his contemplation of the three characteristics of impermanence, suffering, and non-self, he attained arahantship at dawn, having fulfilled the recluse's duty in the three watches of the night. This was his persistent energy. Giving expression to his feelings, he said, "Assuredly let me raise breaking both my legs. To die with lustful mind I loathe and shrink. Having thought thus, I saw things as they are, and with the dawn I reached the Arahant's domain." Coming back to the sutta, the man, by means of that raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, safely crossed to the far shore, and going beyond, he stands on high ground. The far shore, which is safe and free from danger, is a designation for nibbana. Nibbana is the complete fading away and extinction of the craving that brings renewed existence. It is forsaking and abandoning craving, and liberation and detachment from it. Nibbana is not self-annihilation, since there is no one to be annihilated. Standing on high ground represents attainment of arahantship. The word arahant denotes the killer of all defilements, forsaking lust, hatred, and delusion, truly knowing and with mind freed. The arahant clings to nothing here and hereafter. Clinging to none, the arahant has nothing to fear. Now the man feels safe and secure forever. He is endowed with absolute knowledge, the knowledge of the extinction of all suffering. For him who has completed the journey, for him who is sorrowless, for him for whom everything is wholly free, for him who has destroyed all ties, suffering exists not. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. To retell the story once again, here is the original sutta from the Samyutta Nikaya in the Book of the Six Sense Bases. The simile of the vipers. Because suppose there were four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom. Then a man would come along, wanting to live, not wanting to die, desiring happiness and averse to suffering. They would tell him, "Good man, these four vipers are of fierce heat and deadly venom. From time to time they must be lifted up, from time to time they must be bathed, from time to time they must be fed, from time to time they must be laid to rest. But if one or another of these vipers ever becomes angry with you, then, good man, you will meet death or deadly suffering. Do whatever has to be done, good man." Then bhikkhus, afraid of the four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom, that man would flee in one direction or another. They would tell him, "Good man, five murderous enemies are pursuing you," thinking, "Wherever we see him, we will take his life right on the spot. Do whatever has to be done, good man." Then bhikkhus, afraid of the four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom and of the five murderous enemies, that man would flee in one direction or another. They would tell him, "Good man, a sixth murderer, an intimate companion, is pursuing you with drawn sword, thinking, wherever I see him, I will cut off his head right on the spot. Do whatever has to be done, good man." Then bhikkhus, afraid of the four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom, and of the five murderous enemies, and of the sixth murderer, the intimate companion with drawn sword, that man would flee in one direction or another. He would see an empty village. Whatever house he enters is void, deserted, empty. Whatever pot he takes hold of is void, hollow, empty. They would tell him, "Good man, just now village attacking dacoits will raid this empty village. Do whatever has to be done, good man." Then bhikkhus, afraid of the four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom, and of the five murderous enemies, and of the sixth murderer, the intimate companion with drawn sword, and of the village attacking dacoits, that man would flee in one direction or another. He would see a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from danger. But there would be no ferry boat or bridge for crossing over from the near shore to the far shore. Then the man would think, "There is a great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from the danger. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for crossing over. Let me collect grass, twigs, branches, and foliage, and bind them together into a raft, so that by means of that raft, making an effort with my hands and feet, I can safely get across to the far shore." Then the man would collect grass, twigs, branches, and foliage, and bind them together into a raft, so that by means of that raft, making an effort with his hands and feet, he would get safely across to the far shore. Crossed over, gone beyond, the Brahmin stands on high ground. I have made up this miliason, bhikkhus, in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning here. The four vipers of fierce heat and deadly venom, This is a designation for the four great elements, the earth element, the water element, the heat element, and the air element. The five murderous enemies, this is a designation for the five aggregates subject to clinging, that is, the material form aggregate subject to clinging, the feeling aggregate subject to clinging, the perception aggregate subject to clinging, the volitional formations aggregate subject to clinging, and the consciousness aggregate subject to clinging. The sixth murderer, the intimate companion with drawn sword, this is a designation for delight and lust. The empty village, this is a designation for the six internal sense bases. If, bhikkhus, a wise, competent, intelligent person examines them by way of the eye, they appear to be void, hollow, empty. If he examines them by way of the ear, by way of the mind, they appear to be void, hollow, empty. Village attacking dacoits, this is a designation for the six external sense bases. The eye, bhikkhus, is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable forms, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, is attacked by agreeable and disagreeable mental phenomena. The great expanse of water, this is a designation for the four floods, the flood of sensuality, the flood of existence, the flood of views, and the flood of ignorance. The near shore, which is dangerous and fearful, this is a designation for identity. The further shore, which is safe and free from danger, this is a designation for nibbana. The raft, this is a designation for the noble eightfold path, that is, right view, etc., all the way to right concentration. Making effort with the hands and feet, this is a designation for the arousing of energy. Crossed over, gone beyond, the Brahman stands on high ground. This is a designation for the Arahant.